listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright. On October 19th, our own Gemma Gaudette moderated a panel discussion at Boise City Hall with Mayor Lauren McClain, Ada County Commissioner Diana Lacciando, and Boise State University President Marlene Trump. It was part of a conference called the Boise Neighborhood Interactive. During the hour-long conversation, they covered a range of topics, from how to handle exponential growth in the Treasure Valley to improving transportation through partnerships, to what it's like to be a woman in leadership in 2020. To kick off the conversation, Gemma asked Boise Mayor Lauren McClain about community engagement around housing issues. We hope you enjoy this special presentation of the panel discussion, edited for time to fit our format.
What role do you think community members can play in advancing solutions when we look at affordable and attainable housing? Because I think a lot of people, they want to help, they don't know how to help.
There's a couple things on housing. And then of course, very real ways that as residents, you can help us tackle this problem. And first off, I say it's a problem, but I think that there's so much opportunity. We're hearing all over the place that the cost of housing has grown so much more than the wages that we make here. And so we have this issue around affordability. And often as a city, we'll talk about making sure that we have a home for everyone and that we have homes at different price points. And so in my mind, there's the technical portion of affordability. And then there is just the reality of needing to make sure that we have homes in this city that everyone that works here can afford. And we need residents to help us with that. You can engage in planning sessions that we're going to have as we work to rewrite the zoning ordinance. We named a resident committee that's made up of people from around the city, different geographies, different neighborhoods, different backgrounds, that'll be working with us for the first time in 50 years to rewrite our zoning ordinances. And we're going to have a lot of opportunities for residents to engage in that process. We need to hear from you. I need you, we need you to help us recognize, I need you, we need you to recognize that having more homes in our neighborhoods makes it possible for more people to afford to live here and for our neighborhoods to be more vibrant. So as we look at creating a housing bonus ordinance and talking about along transit nodes, so getting to transportation, how we might be able to negotiate with builders of homes on density and parking and other things along transit in exchange for affordability, that'll make our neighborhoods more vibrant. And I need your help in making that possible and in providing us with feedback this fall as we present the ordinance.
Commissioner Lacciando, if you could talk about that as well. I mean, how do you think community members can advance these solutions for housing?
County government is this in-between layer that covers a host of different resources, everything from our courts to our jail to our coroner's office to mosquito abatement. However, in the past, we may have had county commissions who also kind of dipped their toes into really putting housing in unincorporated Ada County. And I think what's going to be important for us going forward is to recognize that there's a cost to growing in that way, and it can be very unsustainable for taxpayers. So one of the things that we've worked really hard on over the last year and a half are creating these conversations called Coordinated Growth for Ada County, working with all six cities and ACHD to really understand how are we growing, what is the fiscal impact of that growth, and is there an opportunity to chart a different course? I think I'm hearing a lot from taxpayers, from citizens who are frustrated by what they see as ever escalating taxes. And there are a few different reasons for that, but one way we can start to get at the root issue is by growing in a more fiscally responsible way. So I know many of you have shared your thoughts with Compass. Those surveys are ongoing, and they're going to inform, hopefully, all six cities' comprehensive plans and their zoning codes, as Mayor McClain noted, as we move forward. So if I don't think that unincorporated Ada County is the best place for new housing to be going in, and that's really because we aren't a city. We don't have a library system. We don't have after-school programs. I truly believe that our growth needs to occur within city limits. Cities are best positioned to provide those resources, and the county should really, I guess pun intended, even though I'm not ACHD, should stay in our lane in providing the things that we do.
And then Dr. Tromp, if you could talk about this from the standpoint of a university where you're dealing with quite a few students who, frankly, access to affordable housing can be critical to them being able to even continue with their education.
Yes, Gemma, thank you so much. That's correct. And I'd be happy to turn on my video, but the host has to release me to do that. So it is a critical issue for our faculty and our students and staff. So the entire landscape of the university, faculty who came here 30 years ago are in a very different position than new faculty coming directly out of graduate school and moving into Boise and looking at the price points for Boise housing. But the same is true for our staff and students as well. We have an enormous population of people to support and serve, and universities bring incredible benefits to communities, but they also need to support the folks that they bring in to work at the university and to attend school at the university. And so we recognize that it's a critical issue, and we're very supportive of the mayor's effort to think through how we can imagine new housing options in the city and even potentially collaborate on options with the city. We've recently conducted a study. We worked with an external firm to come in and assess whether or not additional undergraduate student housing would be useful and beneficial for Boise State University, because some universities historically over the last 10 years or so had overbuilt their housing. And so we brought in a firm to actually assess the need, the demand, and there is a demand. So we're now in the next step of that process, a very clear demonstrable demand. We're now in the next step of that process of working with this firm to assess exactly what that will look like and working with our neighborhoods near the university to make sure that we do that in a way that's good for everybody.
And Mayor McLean, you mentioned transportation in the beginning. And so let's dive into that a little bit more, because I mean, research shows that the Boise's transit system in particular is really, at least pre-COVID, was not where it needed to be to meet people's needs. So if all of you could speak on the work that you're doing specifically around transportation, but also how it would improve our community and you know, from all the way from students, you know, to valley-wide connectivity. So Mayor McLean, again, why don't I start with you on that?
Sure. Thanks, Gemma. And I should have said right at the beginning, it's great to have Commissioner Lecciando and President Tromp, although I'm looking up because she's on the Zoom somewhere, to join in this conversation. And it really, in my mind, illustrates the importance of having different jurisdictions and different entities throughout the region working together on these issues. And transportation, as you rightly said, Gemma, from a systems perspective, is so much more than just what a city can do, a university can do, or how a county might engage. And so, of course, we're working with the Valley Regional Transit and with Council President Clegg's leadership have committed to 5% of our general funds every year to go towards transportation in the Valley. But COVID has shown us in many ways the issues that we have in this community, whether it be around affordability, lack of access to higher wages as needed, the fragility of some jobs, and then the difficulty people have to access those jobs that might be available. And so just as we have to reimagine how we might work and what housing looks like in the future, transportation factors so into that. And so we're not thinking just about buses, just about roads, but really truly mobility. And so strengthening those partnerships that we have with the highway district to attempt to address the needs that our residents have and the desires really that they have to be able to move from home to work, home to school, home to library in safer ways, but not necessarily just in cars. And so we've invested in this year thinking about mobility in a plan that really will map out, just like we did 50 years ago related to the Greenbelt, the land we needed to create a Greenbelt. And we've invested in a plan to show us the land and the opportunities and easements we might need to create so we can connect from the farmland all the way into the foothills through our neighborhoods along canals, not just for bikes, it'd be a great mobility, they'd be great mobility corridors, but also allow like opportunities for new open space and new park-like settings for neighborhoods. And some of these canals are right by the university. Others go through most of the neighborhoods up on the benches, but all in some way connect eventually to the river and close to downtown. And then of course, looking at how we right now with the limited resources we have strategically invest in the bus system, because it isn't what we need. It's going to take a lot of resources and a willingness by many, many agencies to grow it over time. But right now, to take our 5% general fund investments and ensure that the routes on corridors, say Fairview, State, et cetera, run more often so that people can get more often from home to work, and then build from there.
And Dr. Tromp, if you wouldn't mind talking about this as well, because, you know, I remember being a college student and transportation is critical, especially if you end up maybe living a little bit off of campus.
That's right. And especially since many of our students right now are living out, like if they're not living on campus, if they're not living in their residence halls, they're living out in the areas at the margins of the city, which means that it's harder for them to get into campus if there aren't public transit opportunities. And we have a shuttle service that runs to our different campus points in the metro area. But when I had the great privilege to meet with the mayors of all the cities in the Treasure Valley last year, and they asked me what I thought was the most critical issue, one of the things that I said related specifically to this, which was, I said that if we have to cooperate together as cities, and that's why I think it's very important that we've got the county represented here too, because if we build smart transportation networks that allow people to get from place to place, somebody can live in an area that actually meets their needs, fits with them, but still get into Boise if they need to. And then what we don't want is when I was at University of California, Santa Cruz, we had students that were living as far as 75 miles away. And that meant that their round trip commute was many hours and through terrible California traffic. And we don't want our students to contribute to that. So the more we can develop and support the development of that infrastructure, the better it is for everybody. And it also, you know,
okay, Dr. Tromp, we lost you there for a minute. We can see you now. We just lost your audio for a second. So I think we're going to work on that, but I'm going to go to Commissioner Lachiando. I mean, with this idea of not wanting people to have to live so far away, right? And that also goes into the whole idea of affordable housing. You are not ACHD, but that does fall into, you know, you being part of the county. So how does transportation play into all of this?
Well, I think it really comes back to, and I think the mayor and Dr. Tromp have referenced this, that housing plus transportation is really how we have to be thinking about affordability. If housing is very, very affordable, very far away, but you're spending an inordinate amount of money to get someplace, we really have to look at that calculation. And I know it's sounding very trite at this point, especially with this pandemic, but we truly all are in this together. You know, I'm a Boise native, born and raised, and I remember when going to CUNA was, you know, pack a lunch. That was it was a far place to go. And now we have people commuting to work in downtown Boise from CUNA every day and back and forth and vice versa. So we do really need to be thinking about things together. I am going to be a little bit of perhaps the Debbie Downer this morning, however, and that is, we all have really difficult budgets. We have hard competing priorities. And I'll tell you, I was the one commissioner who supported additional funding for Valley Regional Transit this year, but it didn't go through. And that's not necessarily a criticism of my fellow commissioners. It's more a recognition that we have a lot of competing priorities. And for us at the county, 85% of what we do is mandated by the state. We are mandated to have a court system. We're not mandated to fund transportation. So until we get more of a set aside revenue source, I know we've been talking about this for years, whether that is local option tax or something else, I think we're going to continue to struggle with those competing priorities, because there are so many things that we do have to do as a region.
And What also can play into this then is climate change. And people might think, well, how does climate change have to do with housing? But it does go back to that idea of if we have to live far out and then we have to commute it, right? And if you have more cars and buses on the roads. So Mayor, and I know this was a big issue for you when you were running for mayor, is looking at the climate and climate change and how we move forward, right, in a way that is good for our city. And so I'm curious, with climate change and climate migration, the potential, how this is a driver for continued population rise in Idaho. So how can our region be a leader when it comes to finding ways to reverse negative environmental impact?
Sure. You know, climate and climate change that we're experiencing really is connected to everything that we're talking about today, whether it be the cost of housing because of the long-term implications around rising energy costs in a carbon-constrained world, the importance of transit because, one, that helps with affordability if you're not having to pay for an extra car payment and extra gas, but that transportation, when you cut it down, protects your health, makes your quality of life higher, and then economic development. In terms of recognizing that as we transition to clean energy, both here nationally and globally, those communities that come up with the solutions to get there first and early will actually help create opportunity and jobs for their residents and then potentially be able to export that. And now we have the added issue of climate refugees mm-hmm. coming, because many studies are pointing out that our valley is one of those places that will be less impacted by climate change than others. And so while I had a journalist ask me recently, well, what can a city do to stop climate change? This isn't about stopping it. Yes, we want to pause some of the impacts and do everything that we can to minimize them, but it's about mitigation, so keeping our residents safe. It's about adapting, like learning how to live, to commute, to create an economy differently than we have had to in the past. And then ultimately being much more resilient by planning ahead to save money from power and water costs, to save time by looking at transportation, and to build an economy and then the access to opportunity that our kids and grandkids deserve in that transition. And that's why I believe that it's so important that as a city that we think about how we take those steps for our residents in the same way that businesses for a decade now have been taking those steps for their shareholders. I'm looking at this as a way to ensure from a financial perspective that our citizens are better off for the actions that we take today.
So I want to switch gears a little bit, because part of this this whole summit is also looking at the 100th anniversary of the women's right to vote with the passage of the 19th Amendment. And there were supposed to be so many great, you know, live events for this, and then COVID hit. So I want to talk a little bit about diversity and connectedness, having three female leaders on the panel today. Every single one of you has dealt with online trolls. You've dealt with pushback for advancing issues of diversity, of equity, of inclusion, and even for your response to the coronavirus. So what advice do you have for community and business leaders who are working to encourage greater diversity and acceptance in our area? And Commissioner Luciando, I'll start with you.
Oh, wow. Well, I'll just start out by sharing my Sunday, because I think it's very prescient given what you brought up. I am in the midst of an election, so I am, you know, simultaneously doing my day job, managing 12 county departments, working with 6 additional elected officials, while facilitating online learning for my children, and handling a campaign. And it's been rough, but a lot of families are in the same boat. Yesterday, I had just an awesome opportunity to do a Zoom call with a Girl Scout troop. I know, Mayor, you've done that in the past, and just so fun to connect with young people who have great questions, want to understand what I do. But at the same time, I've been texting thousands of voters, and I did have one person respond to me and say, you're the reason why the 19th Amendment never should have been passed. So, you know, you take it all with a grain of salt, I think, because we're in a really difficult time. There's a lot of heightened emotions. There's also with social media and behind the wall of online, it's easy to maybe not have the social graces that you would in another setting. That being said, I think it's so important for our businesses, for our government entities, for our civic groups to continue to model inclusion, to not expect that people will just step up into roles, but to invite them into that roles, to create opportunities for people to engage specifically. And, you know, representation does matter. And I was really grateful to be a part of that Girl Scout troop yesterday because I was able to show them that, look, this is something you can do someday. You too can be in charge of the landfill. So,
and there's mosquito abatement.
And mosquito abatement. So, you know, it is a difficult time right now, but I think we have done a lot of work and we have a lot more to go.
And Dr. Trump, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. I'm curious about your thoughts on this, because when you came on as president of Boise State last year, I mean, one of the first things that was put into your lap was about diversity and inclusion. And to say that you got pushback, I think, is an understatement. And this wasn't even, frankly, something that you had put on your own plate. It was the previous interim president, but yet this is how you walked into the job. So how can you encourage diversity and acceptance, especially for business leaders who really want that in our area?
I have heard from a lot of business leaders that this is a priority for them, but I think a value that Idahoans share and a concept that really is very much a part of Idaho and the Western states. I grew up in Wyoming. Wyoming was the first state to allow women to vote. And as a consequence, the nickname of the state is the Equality State. Idaho was very, very early in that process as well. I think we were sixth or eighth. And so there's a sense, a fundamental sense here about the importance of fairness and equality. And that is a message. When I got that letter, I went on the road and traveled to meet a number of our legislators. And the message I shared with them is that we care about every single one of our students. And I had one legislator say to me, but what about the kid that comes from a small town, you know, a small rural town that hasn't had much interaction and doesn't know much about these issues? And I said, you mean like I was, you know, growing up in a small community in Wyoming. In fact, I have to say that when people described Green River as a small town, I was a little shocked because when I started high school, there were 7,000 people there. It was eventually about 12, but that's big for Wyoming. That's a big city in Wyoming. So when I went to school at and then later taught at the University of Wyoming, we had students that came from towns of 30, 40, 100. Our aim as an institution is to be genuinely, authentically fair and committed to every single student. And I've been talking with some of our staff about these issues because we continue to be a target for any effort that we do for first generation students, for our veterans, because when you talk about diversity, what you're really talking about is ensuring that every single person that sets foot on that campus or in that community is able to thrive to their full potential and give to their full potential. And that's really what universities aim to do. So when we have programs for veterans, it's not because we're saying there's something wrong with veterans, or it's because we want to ensure that veterans have an opportunity to give fully of themselves. Or if we have a student tutoring program for student athletes, because those athletes are traveling to compete on behalf of the university, we want to ensure that they have the support they need so that they can be successful. And so ensuring that we approach every student with the kind of love and care that allows them to thrive and really be successful, I think is transformative for students. And when our students are successful, it's better for the state. In fact, I really have seen a theme in the things that the folks on this panel have been saying, which is that when we work collaboratively and work together and work to improve the conditions, it positively impacts everybody. And what we know is that the more we let everyone's talents shine and we create the conditions for everyone to thrive, the more likely we all are to thrive. And so I think that's a message that resonates with a lot of Idahoans, and it's one that a lot of people care about. And it's that we are, to follow up on what Diane said, we are in a very tense moment. It's a very politically divided moment where people have taken up arms against each other, and there's been such conflict. But I believe that we can problem solve these kinds of challenges together, whether that be issues about our climate or issues about transportation or housing, or even issues about what kinds of programs and support networks are necessary for people.
And Mayor McLean, if you could talk about that a bit as well, because you too have dealt with so much of this pushback as well. And I think it's fair to say online trolls, when you get a comment like Commissioner Lacciando got about this is why the 19th Amendment should not have been passed, you know, that goes back to this idea of when you're anonymous, the things that you can say. But with that being said, if that is what potential companies who want to come in here, right, and they want to bring business to this area, if that's what they see, how do you say, you know what, that's not who we are?
Well, first off, to that question specifically, for the most part, it isn't who we are. And what we're seeing around the country is the same thing happening. And so every mayor, every county commissioner, every university president, if they're talking with a business, mm-hmm. you know, heaven forbid, potential businesses think that the language and vitriol and trolls that they see online are reflective of a community, because they really aren't. And the social media has given people a platform that hadn't existed before, either to spread disinformation or to feel emboldened to write things that they would never imagine saying directly to your face, whether that be in social media or by email, frankly. And then unfortunately to gather together and in some ways to kind of elevate, rile each other up to spur additional action or vitriol, which is not helpful in any issue that we're working on, in any person's role that they might be in, attempting to lead an organization, a city, a company. To have that happening and dividing us is exactly what we don't want to have happening right now when we have so many challenging issues, the pandemic, climate, the economy, race to confront. And we need to do that by figuring out what it is we share in common and how we work together to move forward. And that noise that's out there makes it harder. Mm-hmm. And it's painful to hear it, to read it, to see it. But it's on each of us as leaders to remind ourselves that it's noise so that we can focus instead on bringing people together to get where we know we need to head as a community. And on gender, gender equity, and yeah, like I want to have a do-over for the 100th anniversary right? of the women's right to vote. Like 2021 is going to be the 101 anniversary and a much more fun time to celebrate because our arts and history department and people throughout this valley had plans to really highlight the history. As Marlene said, you know, Wyoming was first. Western states were remarkable in their willingness to give women the vote early and to send, like Montana sent the first congresswoman, first woman to Congress before women could vote in most of this country. So the Northern Rockies in particular recognized, I think, the importance of all participants in our democracy because we were trying to build community with so few resources. None of us were from here. None of us had family here. We needed everyone to work together to come up with a better community. That's what we did from the time that we came upon these places, recognizing natives were here first. Now, we didn't then, that it was their place. It became ours, but it required all of us to work together, and we need that more than ever now. And in this role, Idaho Power, Hewlett-Packard, Micron have reached out and shared with me the work that they're doing and on diversity to ensure that their workplaces are diverse, voices are heard and elevated, because it makes for better businesses. And we're trying to do the same thing here. And I really appreciate that we can do it in partnership with the university, with businesses that are leaders in this community. For me personally, we've committed to ensuring, thinking about how we support other women and young leaders. We've committed to ensuring that all of our city commissions are at a minimum have gender parity. And then I'm also seeking opportunities, if we have a commission with seasoned members on it, to find emergent leaders in our community that I could place on those commissions to build skills and a background that would make it possible for her to find other opportunities later and to kind of create that ladder of success to get involved in our city. And then, of course, like Diana said, talking with the Girl Scouts and other groups like Girls on the Run about the importance of just believing in yourself and staying involved in your school and being a good citizen and all those different things help start early. But there are tangible things that the university, the county, the city, others can do. And we're trying to do that as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the idea of representation. Commissioner Lasciando, you mentioned how representation matters, and we hear that often. But then there seems to be this idea, and frankly, I believe it comes from a place of fear that, well, if a woman wants a seat at the table, or a person of color wants a seat at the table, that means that the traditional person at the table is no longer welcome. And yet, if we realize the table's big enough for everyone, and that in order for us to have, when we talk about things like housing, like climate change, like transportation, all voices need to matter, because not everyone looks the same, not everyone has the same experience. So, Commissioner, can you go into a little bit more depth on your part about why it's so important that representation matters? And I hate always saying, well, Mayor McLean is the first elected female mayor in the city.
I hate it too, because it feels like so much pressure.
Exactly, right. And Dr. Trump is the first female president, at Boise State University. Instead of saying, you're the mayor of Boise, you're the president of Boise State University. And do you know what I'm saying, Commissioner Lasciando, in that idea of getting away from being the first, but also why every voice matters?
Well, I'll make it really personal. I think many, if not most of our employees are navigating really challenging times right now in terms of their work and their family life. And I am too. And I have not shied away from just being out there when, I'm voting on county contracts. My son, who happens to be Gemma's son's friend, he pops in, and sometimes he also votes. And often my kids are walking in and asking about math homework when I'm in the middle of a discussion. And one of the things we've really tried to do during the course of this pandemic is to really support our employees through this really challenging process, letting them know we recognize what they're going through, offering resources when able, providing that flexibility. And to the point about representation, I've had a number of them reach out to me to say, thank you for letting us see that you're dealing with this too. It gives me comfort that I'm also trying to balance things. Things aren't perfect. And I appreciate that your life is as messy as mine. And it absolutely is. So I think that's one way that certainly as leaders, we can show there are different ways to lead, and this is one way to do that.
Well, and I should say my 8-year-old writes notes to me now while I'm live on the air if he's got a question about math. So this is the times we're living in. But Dr. Trump, to that point of representation and it mattering, especially when we look at diversity and inclusion, we have to include those other voices.
Yeah, and I think I want to add something similar to what you all have been saying, which is that, so the reason I'm here remotely today, rather than being there in person with our other leaders, is that I care for my 93-year-old mother in my home. And if we're not talking to the full range of people to understand what the needs are, we're not going to build systems and structures that support those needs. So we have to recognize that we have faculty and staff and students who are at home with their children, who are tugging on their sleeve to help them with their math homework. And we have to think about how that allows us to be more flexible. So I'll give you a specific example of what we've done. We installed $2 million worth of new equipment in our classrooms so that students could be remote for a period, not just during COVID, but be remote if they needed to because they're caring for a child or an ailing family member, or they have to help work to support their family and they need a little more flexibility in their schedule. So if you had to step out to go to a harvest, if you had to step out to care for an ailing family member, if you need more flexibility, we want to be able to provide that with our students. So one of the things that we were able to do during the pandemic is to rethink how we deliver that education. But if we're not asking the whole range, the whole spectrum of our students, if we're not talking with our staff and our faculty, I work very closely with our Professional Staff Association and our Association of Classified Employees, as well as with our Faculty Senate. If we're not talking with those folks and hearing from those full range of voices, we're not going to understand what the challenges are that they're facing and what we need to do as an organization to be responsive to those challenges. So that means also working closely with our ASBSU, our Associated Students of Boise State University, which is the student government. And that student government is meant to be very representative, and it's an incredible group this year. And so we talk with them very, very closely as well. As we look towards the spring, what kind of schedule is going to work best to help control the pandemic and you know, give you the kind of learning experience that you want? But we have to be asking all of those students. And there's a methodology, a way of thinking that came from a lot of advances that have been made in some other nations where people, the model is called the last girl. So if you look at the person who has the least advantages to come to your organization, your institution. So my son is going to be positioned very differently to go to college than I was as a first generation graduate. If you ask about, like, so if we look at our students who are rural students, who are first generation, who don't have access to a lot of the things that even students who are being schooled here in Boise, who maybe their school takes a field trip to go see a museum or to, you know, have access to the things that the city has to offer. If you're rural and you're first generation, we need to understand what you need to be successful at Boise State. And if we figure that out, we'll better serve all of our students. And so if we can figure out how to serve the least among us, then if we think of that biblical language, then we can serve everybody better. And so that's really the way we think about it at Boise State.
And Mayor McClain.
There are a couple of things I thought I'd add on to this. It's a great discussion. You know, first off, with COVID, as Diana said, like, it's made it real. Like, yeah. Life is no longer this thing that we tuck away when we leave home and head to the office, but instead it's forced all of us to recognize that we all have different needs. Many of us are better off than others. We have to figure out how to meet the needs of those, as Marlene said, the least among us. And as I think about equitable access to the programs that we develop, inclusion of marginalized voices and reflective democracy in our city, there are a couple things that we have to do. And so here internally, we are working with, it's called Dignitas, an agency on equity and inclusion, because it's one thing to hire a diverse workforce, but if you don't create the environment in which they want to stay, then you're getting nowhere. And so we need to look internally to make sure that we're creating an environment that welcomes all and embraces the differences that we have. And also at the same time, companies throughout the city are doing the same thing. So we know that it's not just something that Boise wants to do or is doing, but really there's value from an economic perspective as well that's recognized by so many. As we look at a transition to clean energy, so often you see that those who bear the brunt like the negative impacts of climate change, of health impacts of transportation, et cetera, are those that least often benefit from the alternative. And so we will be making sure that as we release opportunities for energy efficiency programming, we look at community solar, we put out proposals for housing, that we're making sure that those that typically wouldn't have the benefits of clean energy, the savings and the health benefits, get those here in the city. And then even community engagement. We can say that we want to hear from everybody. We can say we asked some questions, gave them a chance, but it doesn't, the systems that we have in place don't always work for all people. And so working with our community engagement department, we're seeking ways to ensure that we can go out to various voices to have reflective feedback come back to us as we're making decisions, so that we aren't missing something that could be a simple change just because we ourselves don't think of it. And so we're designing ways to collect feedback from various communities throughout the city that we wouldn't necessarily do before, because we want to make sure that the answers we get, the feedback that we have, and the ideas that are generated are reflective of the city.
So each of you have also mentioned in passing during this conversation about the political times that we're in right now. And Commissioner Lasciando, as you mentioned, you are in the middle of an election season, and there have been some ads out that do attack you. I mean, to the point where I personally find this a bit amusing, in the sense that people have said on social media, if you look, you know, you're the reason why, you know, Idaho is becoming California. There's nothing wrong with Californians if you're here, by the way. So welcome. But it's this idea that's getting out there, because you were born and raised in Boise, and it's not even first generation. So when you have to see these attacks on you, but then also continue to do the job that you were elected to do, can you separate? Is it difficult to do that? And to know, frankly, who you are and why you're doing what you're doing?
Well, it's hard. It's hurtful. It is disappointing. You know, you said it. My mom's family homesteaded outside of Burley. My dad's family came here from the Basque Country. So if I'm told to go back to where I came from, it would be St. Luke's. but I think, you know, more than that, it is unfortunate, because that, you know, we're all really sick and tired of the national rhetoric, and to see that creep into our local elections is I don't really believe it's actually what people want. I really don't. I think people want to come together on issues. And frankly, one of the things I love about county government is that we are the lowest level of government that has to run from a partisan seat. And I wish it wasn't that way. Dottie Owens would be the first one to tell you that there's no way to be a Republican coroner or a Democratic coroner, right? That's just the way it is.
You're just the coroner.
So, and I really appreciate that, really, by and large, at the county level, we work very well together. And, you know, 99% of the time, I'm not giving any thought to what somebody's party is. You know, I'll stand up and tell you here today, even though I'm on the Democratic side of the aisle, I'm not voting a straight Democratic ticket. I'll be voting for Sheriff Bartlett. I vote for competence. And so I think for all of us as citizens, even though there's so much that is trying to pull us in a partisan direction, that's really kind of an easy way out. It's a lot harder to look into issues, to value people and principle and the issues that really matter.
And Dr. Tromp, what about you when it comes to this idea as well, especially from a university level?
One of the really powerful things about universities is that their role has been for over 1,000 years to help be a place where that dialogue can take place. And so I should note that I'm just so keenly aware of all of the hardship that people have gone through. So the pandemic and the illness that has struck some people and taken some lives in our state, the economic hardships that followed in the wake of that with the actions that were designed to help prevent the spread of the epidemic, And then the racial tensions on top of that. And so people are wearied and they're angry and they're frustrated. And I believe it has driven us even farther apart, and it has undermined that sense of that sense that we have that the people who we connect with, even if they disagree with us, share some basic values with us. In fact, there was a study that came out this last year that showed that for the first time in recent American history, so I suspect this is probably true if you go back to the Civil War, but for the first time in recent American history, at least since sociologists have been doing this work, when two factions are at war, physically at war, they perceive the other group as they perceive them as having absolutely no good intentions. So you couldn't possibly have good intentions and be an X. You couldn't possibly have good intentions and be a Y. Therefore, you must be trying to hurt us and imagining bad things about us and trying to hurt the nation or trying to hurt the state. And if you look at what a lot of this rhetoric has been about that has divided us so much, a lot of it is a deep fear, as you said earlier, Gemma, that something will happen that will destroy what we value. That's fundamentally what's at the bottom of this, I think, for a lot of people, is a genuine belief that if their opponents win, it will actually destroy what they value. And I think if we are not talking with each other, it becomes easier to believe that is so. It becomes easier to believe that your opponents want to destroy something that you love. And so I think if universities can be a place where those conversations take place, which means we have to be open to that whole range of opinions, and every student, regardless of his or her politics, regardless of his or her value system, should be able to speak on campus and should be able to engage in the dialogue, and that students should be able to talk through these complex issues with one another, and that our faculty are engaging those complex issues, but giving students the space to make their own choices, because that's what universities do. So I think the university plays a key role in helping us recover from this difficult moment, but I do think it takes time, because there's been so much real hardship, and so much, what we know is that the rhetoric that has circulated on social media has allowed people to become increasingly polarized. And that's going to take some time for us to work through. But I do believe, I really believe that we can find that common ground that the mayor spoke of, that we can work together to solve complex problems. And I'm really proud that universities have been supporting that work for a long time. Our faculty don't have an ideological aim. They're not trying to produce students who think in a certain way. They're trying to produce students who think. And if we can all work together to treat each other with human respect, and to hear one another and talk with one another, and that means from every perspective, then I think that we really will find that common ground and those common solutions.
And with just about 5 minutes left, I just want to hit on leadership very quickly. And as in a simple, but not maybe simple answer, is why is it vital to have women in leadership positions? And Mayor McClain, I'll start with you.
Well, I think I might answer that with the answer that my son gave when he was about 5. I forgot about this until just now, actually. Aiden walked into the room once, and I was, you know, being the mom that was doing multiple things, so not fully paying attention to him. He was like, Mama, can you have a king without a queen be in charge? And I was like, I don't know. And he's like, no. And then he said, and can you have just a queen be in charge? And I said, no. And he's like, yes, you can. And then I actually started paying attention. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, Mom, you need a queen because she's always going to think about all the people. That's why a king needs a queen, but a queen can just do it by herself. And then I thought, like, and I, it was just like one of those things. I told the story once other years ago at Boise State. And to me, it was fascinating that my kindergartner, that, like, I think he must have been reading a book about kings and queens, but could condense something like that so simply. And it's not that you have to have a queen or you have to have a female leader, but as he saw it, much as like people have said nationally and globally now about how countries led by women have dealt with coronavirus, but as he saw it, it was so important to have the either the partnership in one instance or just the mom, because of the importance of caring for people and thinking about everyone and making decisions. And that different perspective that is both innate and then nurtured into us as young girls and women, I think is really important at board tables, on city councils and county commissioners and other places, because we look at things differently.
Commissioner Lachiando.
Well, I think Aiden said it best, obviously, but just to pick up on that, we bring all of ourselves to these seats, right? I am a mom, I am a wife, I am Basque. We bring all of ourselves to these seats, and having that diversity of perspectives really lends itself to thinking through things differently. Throughout the course of this pandemic, I know Commissioner Kenyon and I have been asking questions that I've had moms who are at home working say, thank you so much. That wouldn't have happened before. And maybe it would, or maybe it wouldn't have. But I feel that that is critical to Mayor McLean's point. When we have diversity and representation, we get better ideas, whether it's in the boardroom, on the city council, in the county commission, at the university.
And Dr. Tromp?
Gosh, I don't think there's really anything of substance that I could add. I mean, I think what I would say is it's not so much about having a woman in charge. It's more about being able to hear the variety of concerns that are brought to the table so that we're developing the best solutions for the challenges that face us. So whenever we hear well and hear broadly, we'll develop better, more meaningful solutions.
That was Boise State President Marlene Tromp, along with Boise Mayor Lauren McLean and Ada County Commissioner Diana Lachiando, in a panel discussion moderated by our own Gemma Gaudette. Since this conversation was recorded in October, Lachiando lost her reelection bid on the Ada County Commission. Thanks to the City of Boise for partnering on this special presentation, and thank you for joining us today. Have a question, comment, or idea for the show? Download the new Boise State Public Radio app and use the Talk to Us feature to send us a radio quality audio message. Idaho Matters is produced by Frankie Barnhill and myself, along with production assistant Molly Wampler. Tom Michael and Paul Stribling are our executive producers. Gemma Gaudette will be back Monday for more live and local interviews on this listener-supported service, Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Samantha Wright. You can hear today's program and previous interviews by subscribing to the Idaho Matters podcast.